Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Mara Robbins. She's a practicing poet, creator of Ongoing Narrative, project director for 1,000 Flags, 1,000 Waters, and community organizer who now lives in Richmond, Virginia, after 40 years on the high plateau of the Blue Ridge Mountains in Floyd County, Virginia. She pulls over to move turtles out of the road, works daily to protect and cherish water, loves trees, and cares for people who live in trees to defend what they love from 42-inch fracked gas pipelines. She also might hand you a Sharpie marker and ask you to write poetry on her cargo pants. Her writing has appeared in Floyd County Moonshine, New York Quarterly, Nantahala, Real Simple, Still Journal, and other eclectic publications. So first, thank you for being on the program, and second, thank you for your work in the world.
Oh, thank you, Derek. And I just want to make sure I let our listeners know that it is Nantahala, which ironically is not a publication that exists anymore, but I absolutely love the Nantahala River down in North Carolina. So I just felt like saying it out loud.
Great.
Yeah.
So tell us about water in Virginia. Just go.
Okay. So at the moment, I am sitting next to an unnamed tributary to Meredith Creek. Meredith Creek is the closest creek to where I currently live outside Richmond and Glen Allen. And this little creek just barely escaped some concrete up the, about a block up the street, and is in the middle of a riparian barrier that is a little glimpse of wildness in the suburbs of pine trees and gum trees. And this is a very different sort of water and environment than I'm used to. As I mentioned in the bio that you just shared, I spent 40 years on the high plateau of the Blue Ridge, and the water there is very different than it is here in the flatlands of Virginia. Where I come from in Floyd County, no water flows into Floyd from outside. All of our water comes from the sky. And because Floyd's on a triple divide, it feeds over 10,000 miles of watershed, 28 counties, four major metropolitan areas, the Roanoke, the New, and the Dan River watershed. All parts of each originate in the waters of Floyd County. And so I grew up from 8 years old until last June having a very intimate relationship with water. I carried water for a family of five when I was about 10 years old. We didn't have running water for a minute. And honestly, I really wish that everybody in the world could live without running water for a week. I think a week would be long enough to really appreciate the weight of it. You know, how much we, at least in the United States, many of us tend to rely on the fact that water is going to come out of the faucet when, you know, that water comes from somewhere. And when you know where it's coming from and how much it weighs, you have a whole different appreciation for how you use it, how you utilize it. And so that has just always been a part of me. I've always loved water as well, swimming, wading in creeks. You know, when I was very young, I used to constantly ask my mom and dad, like, I see a lake, can we stop? I see a creek, can we stop? Like, everywhere we went. And so I think that even though originally our focus in Floyd County, when we were threatened by a 42-inch fracked gas pipeline, the Mountain Valley Pipeline, for about 3 months within the county borders in 2014, our initial major concern and focus was our water. It took me a minute to come back around to the water in terms of my community organizing within the pipeline resistance, which has been ongoing for about 5.5 years now. I've seen a lot of water in Virginia and around the country from the ocean. There is a small strip of coastland in the Commonwealth of Virginia, you know, all the way to the far, far western portions, which is just some of the most beautiful country in the world. West Virginia and Tennessee, Kentucky and Virginia all kind of come together in that area. But I'm most intimate with the waters of Floyd County and the surrounding region, and most specifically the named water bodies that are threatened by the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, and some of which have already been damaged by the construction of the Mountain Valley Pipeline, due to my work with Thousand Flags, Thousand Waters, which is one of the best projects I've ever done in terms of being a water protector.
So there's a few directions we can go, and you can go, I'm going to just lay out some options, and you can take whichever one of these or all of them, however you want. One of them is, can you talk about some of the non-humans who live in or near streams, or rivers? Two would be, can you talk about more about these pipelines, a little bit of the history? What are the potential harms by them? What are the real harms by them? Realized harms, potential and realized harms.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third possibility for now would be talk about Thousand Flags, Thousand Waters. So you can do any or all of those.
So let's do the first two.
Okay.
Because the pipeline and the endangered species in particular are all intermingled. I mean, all of this is, but so just as a frame of reference, Floyd County was threatened by the Mountain Valley Pipeline, which is a 42-inch high-pressure transmission pipeline, which would carry fracked gas from Mobley, West Virginia, to the border of Virginia and North Carolina, and they're currently trying to get an extension into North Carolina. We faced it first in July of 2014, and it moved several times and just outside of our borders in Roanoke County in the fall of that year. I've been active in the pipeline resistance ever since. And one of the things that changed in terms of our pipeline fight in the winter of 2017 was when the 401 water quality certifications were issued by the State Water Control Board. Virginia has a unique system. Our Department of Environmental Quality is advised by a citizens board that is appointed by the governor. And so these citizens, with big quotation marks, were the ones that approved the permits, which basically allowed the pipeline to be built. New York stopped the Constitution pipeline by disallowing the 401 permits. And after that happened, there were many courageous individuals who at that point stepped away from the system and took matters into their own hands. And as of February of 2018, we had two tree sits go up on the top of Peters Mountain, which was on the border of Virginia and West Virginia. This tree sit became known as the Hellbender Autonomous Zone. And a hellbender is a very unique creature, somewhere between like a salamander and a large lizard, very prehistoric, you know, lives in the mountainous creeks and is threatened. And at that point in time, the Mountain Valley Pipeline had made an argument for early entry to cut trees based on the fact that they could not cut after March 31st because of the endangered Indiana bat. They nest in tree bark. And you really can't find them easily once they're nesting, not that they really looked. But that was their self-imposed deadline to get early entry. And part of the original plan, as I understand it, was to hold off construction by living in these trees until that deadline had passed. Now, the problem with that is that they don't really care about deadlines or permits. They pay them off. You are, I'm sure, very familiar with the way that industry, I refer to them as the petro-colonizers, of this land tend to work within the system, and the system privileges them. But the direct action that happened in resistance to the MVP really began in February. And after those tree sits went up, there was something called a monopod that was erected in the middle of a Forest Service road, which made it impossible for them to take vehicles up the mountain. This was a few miles down from where the two original tree sits went up. And as of April 2nd of 2018, a 61-year-old woman in Bent Mountain, Virginia, and her daughter went up in two trees on property that they had lived on for seven generations. Red and Minor Terry were the first directly affected residents who took to the trees to defend them from the pipeline. And I was primary ground support for Red. I lived about 10 minutes away at the time and was pulled in from the very beginning. Red and the campaign that followed, Stand With Red, received international attention. It really brought a lot of eyes to our plight in Southwest Virginia and, you know, gleaned a lot of attention. But after 34 days, when they were going to be fined $1,000 a day if they stayed in the tree, their decision was that they didn't want any money going into the pockets of the petro-colonizers. And so they came down and they cut down all of those trees the very next day. And, you know, this is, for me, part of defending what we love, taking a stand in resistance to the machine, so to speak, has to do with protecting the water. And I think that water protectors became synonymous with pipeline resistance after Standing Rock. And that is certainly part of why we use that name in solidarity. But I think I've always considered it part of my responsibility to the world to really do what I can do to cherish and protect the water. And Bottom Creek in Bent Mountain, Virginia, is a Tier 3 waterway. Different waterways are afforded different protections from the powers that be, 1, 2, and 3. And a Tier 3 waterway is pristine water. Bottom Creek is so clean, you can drink directly out of the creek. And it's one of only 33 water bodies that have been given that designation in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And despite that, the Mountain Valley Pipeline received permits to cross it over 36 times. And Red and Minor were both camping in trees right next to this pristine creek. It's unfathomable to me that we do what we do with this world that we consider some sort of resource when really we're a part of it. And, you know, by commodifying it the way that we do, we're commodifying ourselves. And I still feel very much like I am part of those woods and those trees and the fiddleheads that came up as spring emerged through the month of April. I still feel half feral in this world sometimes, because even though I live very close to the land for a long time, I wasn't living in the woods for an extended period of time. And it's you know, you become a part of the world and the world becomes part of you, the earth, the water. And I honestly have a lot of compassion for people who don't know what that feels like, because I think we are so separated from our natural environment in this day and age that the constructs that we've made have become what's real, rather than the ecosystem of which we are intimately a part. And, you know, that said, doing that, playing that role within the resistance, takes a toll. It takes a toll on the people who are taking direct action. It takes a toll on the people who are standing in support. And I think one of the things I'm exploring right now is the trauma that I see, for example, in this little unnamed tributary. They call them UNTs, and UNTs, capital UNT is an abbreviation in the DEQ documentation. When a creek doesn't have a name, it's a UNT. So this little unnamed tributary here is obviously compromised by humans. And I sometimes look at these bodies of water and look at our bodies and the way that we carry trauma from what we have to live with, and see a lot of similarities, because it's, you know, it's ongoing. You can't fail to be affected by it these days if you're paying any sort of attention. But those who are living in the middle of this ongoing destruction of our planet, it takes a particular toll for those who are directly affected. And those are the people that are in my mind and heart the most as I go about, I guess, trying to elevate the conversation, trying to take this message and this story and these protections for our waters and for the people who don't have access to clean water into the larger dialogue. It's, you know, it's the grassroots is where I come from. And I think that probably leads into my work with the water flags, unless you had a follow-up question from anything I just said.
Well, I do have one, and then let's go to the water, the Thousand Flags, Thousand Waters. This was early on in what you were saying, that you were talking about how Bottom Creek was one of 33 labeled in Virginia as Tier 3. And I just think that we need to say explicitly that prior to conquest, had they been ranked, almost every stream in Virginia probably would have been Tier 3. That,
yep.
It's so easy, you know, now you live in Richmond and, you know, I have lived in cities too, and it's easy to forget that cities are big clear cuts. And at one time, every place, you know, I went through back in 1989, I got a wild hair and drove up to Northwest Territories. And one of the wonderful things was there was this road that was 300 miles, and the road wasn't wonderful. This road that was 300 miles of unbroken forest. And the entire time I was there, I kept thinking, it was like this everywhere.
Yeah.
And so I just, can we focus on that for just a moment? Can you focus on that for just a moment and say whatever you think about it, and then we'll go to Thousand Flags, Thousand Waters.
Yes. And thank you. You know, sometimes I can almost picture that. You know, I've spent enough time in enough wild places that I've been able to see for miles, you know, with no human interference. And yes, I believe that it's really important to remember that all of these streams and creeks and rivers and springs were quote-unquote Tier 3 waterways before we got our hands on them, before conquest, as you said. And I find it somewhat ironic that it is the ones that are the most pristine that are the ones that we designate deserving of further protections. You know, what about the waters that need more help? I was at a meeting for the Air Pollution Control Board once and heard the argument that the air in Buckingham County, Virginia, is much cleaner than the rest of Virginia. Therefore, we could afford to pollute it a little more with the Atlantic Coast Pipeline's giant compressor station. They're trying to put in the middle of a environmental justice community. And I mean, the whole argument astounds me, but that particular one from people who are supposed to be protecting our air from pollution, that's not what they do. They permit pollution. And it's been difficult to remember that at times because, you know, we want those agencies that are supposed to protect us to protect us, but they don't. And so it is my hope that one of the changes that we can make as we move forward, because we have no choice but to change, is to really honor and value the water that we have, the water that is rising, but that will be salt water, you know, to really look at the sources of these waters and to do what we can do to clean them up and to, you know, flush our toilets with our gray water, for goodness sake. I mean, there's so many ways in which we can treat our water differently if we were to actually have a relationship with it, rather than, you know, to see it as something else that we're entitled to use up. And I feel like that's how, you know, we treat most things on this planet right now, but that there were a lot of people, and granted, I engage with a certain sphere, but I am seeing more and more people who are at least alarmed by what's going on and who are willing to make a change. And I think that one of the biggest changes that we could make is to, you know, picture what these waterways were like before conquest and to do what we could do to, if not return them to that state, to at least do everything that we can do to keep our pollution out of them, to, you know, render them closer to what they were before we started changing them for the worse. I'm hoping we can change things for the better.
There's two more. Thank you for that.
Most days. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for that. And I thought of two more things before we go to Thousand Flags, Thousand Waters. One of them is, I loved what you said about you wish that everyone would have to carry water for a week. And when you said that, the first thing I thought of is I'm guessing that if people had to carry the water, they would probably not do aerial spraying irrigation of their lawn. I'm just thinking that, and I'm not specifically going off after our lawns, although I don't like them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that if we, I think about this when I flip on lights, when I use water, I think about a phrase that William Catton talked about. He talked about how the cheap energy gives us ghost slaves, that there are effectively, we have, if people had to carry all the water upstairs, then a lot of luxuries would disappear because they just wouldn't be worth it. But because we can push the expenses of it off onto the natural world through sucking water from a stream, et cetera, et cetera, I think a lot of things would be non-issues. That's all.
I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. And I think that it's...
Golf courses. Can you imagine hand-carrying the water to water golf courses?
I can imagine hand carrying water from the tiny unnamed tributary at the Yellowfinch blockade, which is currently the longest standing blockade against the MVP in Southwest Virginia in Elliston, because they had a garden there this summer and had to carry it from, they'd call it Nettle Creek, for one of the first sitters in the trees was named Nettle, and so we've named the creek Nettle Creek. And so, yeah, the buckets, 5-gallon buckets up a hill to the garden, which thrived over the summer, helped feed the people who lived there. I am aware of what that takes and how it can be done. Most people probably aren't, because most of us don't have the foundation that I had of being lucky enough to have parents that said, forget the corporate world, and moved us to the mountains when I was 8 and, you know, left behind the constructs of society as my father saw what development and progress was doing to the Raleigh-Durham area where we lived in North Carolina. So I was afforded that privilege, so to speak, of poverty from the perspective of the rest of the world. But it taught me, you know, something that's very deeply ingrained now, and that's, you know, my relationship to the soil, my relationship to the water, my relationship to light and dark, the seasons, when the berries get ripe, that sort of thing, which is not really a part of most people's world as they're developing a sense of individualization. So I consider that a great gift and a privilege, and yet it's frustrating, to say the least, to feel like I'm on the fringe of so much. Like there is so much that I don't understand, because my attention was really turned to the natural world and in a fairly close sphere, which I think is one of the ways we develop intimacy with the earth, is by really getting to know a piece of the planet very, very well. But it doesn't always lend itself to functioning well in the, you know, say big box stores with a lot of fluorescent light, tends to sometimes trigger my PTSD. I just don't cope with it well. And although that's inconvenient, it's an inconvenience that I welcome, because it, you know, allows me to tell the stories that I need to tell. And so I'm really grateful to you for that opportunity, because I just veered so off the original question. I forgot what it was. Oh, it was about carrying water. And I want to share this story because it is so simple, and yet it amazes me every time I'm there. There's a small community here in Richmond called Earth Folk, and they have one tiny bathroom in this renovated old farmhouse that's shared by the community. And the plumbing underneath the bathroom sink is taken off. So there's a pipe that comes directly out from the bottom of the sink and goes into a bucket, which they use to flush the toilet. And they have a small piece of paper there explaining how to do it, you know, and when the bucket gets half full, just dump. And it just strikes me every time I'm there how simple that is. We just flush the toilet with the water we wash our hands with, instead of using clean water, and that's more clean water that we're not using to flush a toilet with, which we don't really even need a flushing toilet, but we won't go there. It's like one small thing that just we can change in our habits of the way that we live in the world that would make at least a small difference, and that everybody could do it pretty simply. And so for some reason, that was something I thought of when you asked that question. Yeah, if everybody were to carry their water and feel the weight of it, it would change our golf courses. Our lawns might be gardens. You know, we could feed ourselves instead of spraying the earth with herbicides and pesticides. Sometimes, you know, from a helicopter, if, you know, you're the MVP and you have pellets you can use for erosion control. But that's another story. So let's not go there yet.
So the I have another question before we go to Thousand Flags, Thousand Waters, and that's
certainly
can you talk, can you be explicit about the harms caused by the potential and realized harms caused by a pipeline? So far we have they have to cut down trees to put the pipeline in, and then that habitat. I mean, when you were talking about the bats, I was like, great. So what you're doing is you're making it so you're not going to kill the bats who are directly roosting or nesting in trees right then, but that doesn't alter the fact that you're killing the home that they would have been living in for.
Oh,
so just Derek, talk about the harm caused by it.
But they did kill the bats. They killed so many bats because they didn't even start cutting in Bent Mountain until April 9th. They were supposed to stop on the 31st. We had a citizens' proclamation that they weren't allowed to do what they were doing, and it didn't matter. They cut down so many trees with so many nesting bats. I mean, it's murder. You know, it really is. They murdered bats. They murdered whippoorwills. They murdered hellbenders, all sorts of endangered species, you know, including plant life that only grows in that part of the high plateau. So yeah, I get angry because it's really wrong what they're able to get away with, and therefore I just got angry and I once again forgot the question because you mentioned the bats, and I'm attached to those bats. You know, I love bats for one thing. I just find it fascinating the way that they fly. We also have flying squirrels in that region, and just the, you know, the magnificence of this tiny animal that, you know, is able to live in the way that they live. But to have such a vulnerable, threatened species, I mean, and all of the birds, so many birds, songbirds, raptors, you know, who were, it's spring, it's nesting season, and they cut down trees through the whole thing. But you asked me about the pipeline and the harms to the water. Let's talk source to destination, because this gas comes from fracking. Fracking is bad. Fracking kills children. It is now a proven fact through multiple studies that there are cancers caused, that we don't even know still what sort of toxic cocktail they use to frack with because of the Halliburton loophole way back when. And everybody can Google this, and please do, because the fracking process is reprehensible. I met Governor Wolf at an event in Westchester back in August, and I shook his hand and I said, you need to stop these pipelines. There's currently the Mariner 2 is being constructed through Chester County because you are killing children. I mean, it is that simple. Children, animals, etc. The fracking process, and this frack gas from Pennsylvania and West Virginia is going to Mobley, West Virginia. There's actually one special pipeline that's only about 30 miles long they're trying to build just to take it from Pennsylvania to West Virginia, where it can go from there into pipelines. There's quite a hub there in Mobley. It's called a Hammerhead. And just the mascot potential there, right? Because there's so many pipelines that we're having to fight. Virginia is not as much of a sacrifice zone as Pennsylvania and West Virginia are, although it's rapidly becoming one, especially Southwest Virginia, where I'm from. The Atlantic Coast Pipeline has gotten a lot of attention, in part because it's taken through more populated areas, and because it's longer, and because Duke and Dominion, the primary investors, are bigger corporations. But in the meantime, they're not constructing the ACP. They're constructing the Mountain Valley Pipeline. And sometimes that kind of gets shoved under the rug by media, which is infuriating to those of us who have been in the path of the destruction. It harms the water through the fracking process. It harms the water simply through laying pipe, because the coatings on these pipes are carcinogenic. And it harms the water when they plow through the water to put the pipelines in the ground, which technically they're not permitted to do right now. The permits to cross water bodies were pulled last October 5th in West Virginia. They were applied to Virginia on the 7th. And despite the fact that our Attorney General, Mark Herring, in Virginia filed a lawsuit with over 300 documented violations against the Mountain Valley Pipeline, he did not void the permit. He did not, you know, nobody stopped construction while this all took place. The lawsuit was won. They were fined ridiculous amounts of money. I think it worked out to about $6,000 or $7,000 per violation. And yet they didn't stop. Right now there is a stop work order from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And they're still working. They're calling it erosion control, but they're going in, pulling up the erosion control they've already done so they can put it back in so they can keep their workers working. And there are still plenty of people who will talk about jobs. And I've got answers for that. But it's already damaged the water. I mean, the Blue Ridge Parkway is the only place that they've actually laid pipe in Roanoke County. And I suspect they did that simply so they could cut under the Blue Ridge Parkway before a legal case was won saying that they couldn't. And in the process of doing that, they completely destroyed an unmapped wetland, a wetland that had not been put on their official maps. And they dug it up and they patted it back down. And this place where turtles had nested forever, probably, you know, for as long as there had been turtles. And all the local people knew that the turtles crossed the road there, and that was just destroyed, drained away. And they put, you know, this pipe in the ground that just the pipe will contaminate the water, you know, and there's not even gas running through it, nor do I think there ever will be, because I think they won't be able to complete it. They won't be able to run gas through it. That's also what I have to believe, you know, in order to keep resisting, which is exhausting at times. So, you know, I choose to believe that, knowing that whatever happens, we will have won, simply for the community that we have built around this struggle over 5.5 years here. I mean, it's been an ongoing struggle forever, but it also, you know, this has been the part that I've turned my attention to most completely, you know, in a way that it really has, you know, embodied me in a lot of ways from the moment I found out. That's it, due to a lot of factors, but I'm gonna shift gears here, because one of the ways to find out some scientific specifics about each and every water body that would be harmed by both of these projects, the Mountain Valley and Atlantic Coast Pipelines, is through two studies that were done by the Natural Resources Defense Council, oh, I think about 2 years ago at this point, maybe not quite that long. And that's what Thousand Flags, Thousand Waters was based upon, inspired by. There's over 1,100 water bodies that would be destroyed by the Mountain Valley Pipeline, and over 1,500 that would be destroyed by the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. There is no way to build these pipelines without destroying these waters, harming them, causing damage, permanent damage, and also to people's wells and springs, people's drinking water. Often in rural agrarian communities where that is the water that people have. They're not on a public water supply. They depend on the water that comes from the ground to drink. And so after trying a lot of different angles, which I have been involved in nearly every aspect to this fight. I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a politician, but I have learned to speak fluent legalese. I have learned what playing politics actually means some days. And it's not just politicians, I might add. And I have a great deal of respect for science as well. But what I do is often the stories. I work in the court of public opinion. I work with people and I work with water. I consider myself a sort of minister to rivers at this point, because after doing things in a more or less legitimate way for a long time, and trust me, I do push the envelope, I just don't always push it all the way into the mailbox. It's been surprising to many people that I have not actually ever been arrested, almost many times, and I've gotten kicked out of many a meeting, but I have not actually committed an act of deliberate civil disobedience. And you know, when I do, I'd like to be very, very deliberate about it. So I'm glad for that. Art and expression, these stories, these words, such as you and I are engaged in right now, people's, you know, ability to connect with each other, that's what this project really was born in. You know, that and the intention to do something through art that could also encourage community involvement and protections for the water. And when I was primary ground support with Red Terry in Bent Mountain, we had made a string of prayer flags at an event just a few days before she went up that we hung around the perimeter of her sit, where they had strung police tape to keep us from resupplying her with food and water. We hung up the prayer flag for the Washington Post the day that they were going to visit. We decided we would decorate, you know, along with our signs and everything else. And that became, by the time she came down, about three quarters of her sit was circled with all these different wishes on strips of cloth that people wrote on with Sharpie markers or painted or, you know, duct taped to these strands, you know, wishing her well, expressing their desire to stop the pipelines, protect the water, protect the Indiana Bats. And it was just a beautiful organic community project. And the water flags were inspired part by that. Right now, there are two strands of flags depicting all of the named water bodies that would be destroyed by the ACP and MVP that have been all over Virginia, West Virginia, North Carolina at least once, Pennsylvania twice, and are now about to be hung in the Chicago Museum of Contemporary Art, thanks to Jenny Kindler, the artist in residence I'm working with, who was approached by them for an exhibit called Water After All. So as of December 14th, those original flags, along with a brand new strand that she's creating, will be hung there. So we're in the process of creating new ones. It's a very good visual depiction of those water bodies, as well as just what people want to put on the flags. You know, that's been a big part of the way that the project has evolved. Originally, we called it the Virginia Water Flag Project, and we sent out large community flags on Phoenix poles. And a Phoenix pole is a piece of wood that comes from a tree that was murdered by the Mountain Valley Pipeline. So we took sticks, twigs, branches from trees that were cut down, and we put the flags on those sticks, and they have been to many a rally and demonstration and even meetings. I've had them strung up across a meeting room at State Water Control Board meetings. Not the sticks, they don't like those in the room, but the flags on the strands. And so they have shown up all over, and those blue swallowtail flags have really become iconic with the water bodies, you know, here in Virginia and in the surrounding area. And some have made it further. My friend Maury Johnson took one made out of a denim to a fellow named Art Tanderlip in Nebraska, who's worked with Bold and stood in resistance to the Keystone Pipeline, you know, as well as a lot of other places. And at this point, we are transitioning from flag material, which tends to be ripstop nylon, to natural fibers that we're dyeing with indigo. Because to me, it just, you know, to Jenny and I both, it really just seemed wrong to be using a form of plastic to represent the water. So at this point, it will be cotton, bamboo, anything that is natural fiber. And it is my hope as we move into 2020 that we'll be actually creating indigo dye from, you know, a bucket of water that we scooped out of, say, the James River, which is the river I'm most intimate with here in Richmond. So that when we make James River water flags, we're putting the indigo into the James River. So it's not just a symbol. You know, there is actually part of the river in this flag. And that to me is extraordinary. And it's very, you know, community building. It's been a real way to bring people together that celebrates water and allows us to grieve and allows us to rejoice, because it's really wonderful to get in clean water when it's hot. And that's happened a lot as well, impromptu celebrations. But also to do everything we can do to bring the water forward as part of our communities instead of separate from our communities. That's, you know, for example, the water flags that are going to be hung in Chicago shortly, it's my hope that Lake Erie has been given rights of nature, which is a very innovative legal tactic that is utilized by the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund at this point and has been applied to rivers, wild rice. All of Ecuador has rights of nature, where it really just turns the system on its head so that, you know, a river can actually be represented in a court of law rather than somebody being fined for polluting it. So given that Lake Erie has received rights, I think that it would be a perfectly reasonable ask for the city of Chicago to demand that Lake Michigan also have rights of nature and that that lake be considered part of their community instead of separate from it. And I think simply that shift in thinking, that shift in feeling, the way that we feel about our environment is going to be a huge part of how the dominant paradigm is going to have to change if we actually want to survive on this planet. We're not going to be able to do it in the way that we're doing it right now.
Well, that would be a wonderful place to end. But is there, we've got like 1 or 2 minutes left. Is there anything else you want to say about any of this?
I want to encourage people to get involved. Whatever it is that you do, whatever it is that you love, bring it to the table, because it is going to take all of us, and it's going to take a lot of work, and it's going to take a willingness to be able to let go of the way that we think things are supposed to be. And it's going to take a willingness to both, you know, acknowledge and address our trauma, both individually and collectively. Because you can't live in this world without being traumatized. And this is why we have so many sociopaths, at least because we are so disconnected. And I think the more we are able to connect and bring what we love to the table, the more we rely on each other and not some elusive vision of this mythical future that isn't going to happen unless we create it. And that happens now. That happens in this moment with your neighbors, with the people you care about, when you bring what you love and what you're good at to the table. Because if you don't, it's not going to be sustainable. If you try to do something you're not good at because you think you have to, because you feel compelled to, given the dire nature of our circumstances, it's not going to work. We have to be able to know what we love and to bring what we love to each other and to defend, to be willing to defend what we love. And I'm grateful to be working with people who are actively doing that. And I'm really grateful to folks like yourself, Derek, who bring this conversation to the, you know, to a wider set of ears.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. And thank you especially for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Mara Robbins. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.